Despite moments of infatuation on both sides, these were not love relationships. The few hustlers accepted, they were not business relationships. They were encounters whose most important aspect was that mutual pleasure was exchanged. An aspect that, yes, colored all other aspects, but that did not involve any sort of life commitment. Most were affable but brief because, beyond pleasure, these were people you had little in common with. Yet what greater field and force than pleasure can human beings share?
Holy-o.
And welcome once again to the Spouter Inn. I'm Chris.
And I'm Suzanne.
And this time we are reading Samuel R. Delaney's Times Square Red, Times Square Blue.
And it's so awesome.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Mm. This is the first piece by Samuel Delaney you've read, is that right?
It is. I like kind of dipped into and out of some of his science fiction writing, but I never engaged with it in a sustained way. And it's not because I didn't want to. It's just like something else came up or whatever. It was a kind of interruption. So I've been meaning to read his work for a long time. And then you put me onto this at one point and I was like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of Samuel Delaney. I have read, I don't want to say all of it because he's written quite a lot, but I've read a significant portion of what he's written. And he is certainly one of my favorite living writers. And I'm super glad that you enjoyed this book, which I read when it first came out about 20 years ago. And it meant a lot to me, and it molded how I think about all sorts of things, which we get to talk about today.
That's funny. I was going to ask you if you were more drawn to his fiction than his nonfiction, because I had only known about him in terms of his fiction until relatively recently.
I think they're both great. He's somebody whose mind you just want to take a nice bath in. they both mean a lot to me.
You encountered his work really early on, is that right?
I had a friend who was trying to get me into it when I was in my early 20s, and I picked up one of his most famous novels, Dahlgren, which is massive and tricky and postmodern and weird as all heck, and great. But when I was first reading it, I couldn't really get into it. I got about 20 pages in and put it down and was just like, no, I don't have the energy for this right now. Mm-hmm. And then I met him.
Yeah, wow.
I was taking a poetry workshop with the great Bernadette Mayer, and he was a guest who came in, and it was a very small class at that point, and I was young, and I knew he was sort of somebody to respect, mm-hmm. but I hadn't actually read anything, so I wasn't feeling sort of overwhelmed mm-hmm. with hero worship or anything, and I kind of monopolized the conversation during that little seminar, but none of the other people in the class were really all that excited about talking with him, so I just chewed his ear off for 2 hours, and we talked about all kinds of literature, and it was great.
Oh, look at you. So that's neat. So you got to know him on that level first and in the classroom and then through the books.
And then I read him and I was quickly won over to his style of writing.
Yeah, he's a beautiful prose style. I mean, there's many things to say, but he's a beautiful stylist. And, you know, this is a book that is also kind of two books. It's, you know, two parts or two things. We'll talk about that. And they're both beautifully written and very differently written, which I find kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, and as I guess we'll talk about in a moment, he's written in a number of different genres and in a number of different modes. And yeah, he's generally very strong as a stylist.
Do you want to say a little bit about his bio before we start talking about the book?
Sure, absolutely. So Delaney was born April 1st, 1942, which just seems like a great day to be born. I don't know, April Fool's Day in 1942. Something about that sounds just right. And he was born in Harlem. He started writing a lot when he was very young. They put out a volume of his teenage journals not too long ago. It's thick as all heck. I've gotten about a third of the way through it. And it's fascinating spending time with like teenage Samuel Delaney. But anyway, he had his first novel published when he was about 20, and he quickly followed that up by seven more. They were generally acclaimed within science fiction circles, but he had a sort of big breakthrough outside of science fiction with Dahlgren, which I just described. It came out in 1975, and it is very Joycean. It's very experimental. It's a post-apocalyptic novel. It's great, but it's a lot of work to read, at least the first time through. And he's written, as I was saying, in a bunch of different genres. He wrote fantasy, which I guess is not a terribly surprising jump from science fiction, but his Neverion series is really probably my favorite work of his. Mm. He's done a lot of critical writing, including a lot of important essays about the nature of science fiction writing. And he's written a lot of memoirs. He's got this autobiography called The Motion in Light and Water, which is fantastic. He's got a memoir about his time in the 60s living in this sort of free love commune called Heavenly Breakfast. And perhaps most intriguingly, he's written a lot of pornography. biography, including the massive and striking novel Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, which came out in 2012, and it's like 800 pages long, and it's really good.
Wow.
And I have this fantasy in my head of teaching it and Middlemarch and a book that both of those books were influenced by, Spinoza's Ethics.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They both are really interesting intertexts with Spinoza's Ethics, but sadly, I've never gotten through the Ethics, so I'm not really qualified to say much about it. It's really great. I can't. It is totally porn, though. Let me make this clear. It's very much taking place in the porniverse, and it is a gay porn fantasia, and it is amazing.
You don't often, you know, put gay porn and Spinoza together, but it sounds like he's done this.
He's absolutely done it, and it's true to both, right?
Wow.
He is very adamant that it's porn, and it is, and yet it is very earnest, and it's a really interesting sci-fi tale, and et cetera. Like, we could try that one someday, too. Mm. He had an interesting life as well. He realized he was gay quite young, and he started hooking up with strangers when he was still in his teens, I believe. He got married when he was also fairly young to Marilyn Hacker. She knew everything about his life. Like, this was not like some secret or anything. He was very open about it, even though it was the late 50s, early 60s at this point. They had a child together. Eventually, they divorced. And what else? He went to college for a semester, but dropped out and started publishing novels. And that's worked out well for him. After Dahlgren came out, he was invited to teach at the University of Buffalo. And he taught in academia in various institutions for decades after that, until he finally retired in 2015. So you can start teaching in college with only one semester of college under your belt. Why not?
Yeah, you know, he seems like a very exceptional person in every way.
Absolutely. I think that comes through a lot, even in this book.
Yeah, it's interesting in the first part, you know, that has this memoir-like quality, which we're going to talk about in a second. You see, how can I put it? He shows you himself reflected through the eyes of other people at certain moments. And those are really haunting, I think.
It's an interesting text for him, partially for that reason, because although he's written a few memoirs, the first half of this is sort of the most journalistic he's gotten that I've encountered, where he's really like letting other people tell the story, even if sometimes that is the story of him. So, you know, some of the sexual encounters he had, he will talk about, but sometimes it's other characters saying, oh, you know, because you know what you're into, and therefore, you know, it's this familiarity, but it's also the sense of other people telling his life in interesting ways.
And people being familiar with him, that is people knowing him, you know, in the way that you, how can I put it, you greet someone when you've known them for a long time. That quality is really extraordinary. I don't think I've seen that anywhere else.
Yeah, that quality is very interesting. So why don't you go into a little bit more detail about what you found in this book when you read it for the first time?
Yeah. So this is not, I said a little bit earlier, this is not one thing but two things. It's a pair of essays that are very different, but they completely fit together. So it's one thing and also two things. And Delaney says this really neat thing about these two essays in his preface. He says, a few readers have suggested not so much that the two pieces are good to think with, but rather that their very differences make them particularly productive for thinking about and against and through each other. If this is the case, their abutment, one against the other here, is worth it. And this idea of the two pieces, like they each do a thing in themselves, but when they're next to each other, there's something else there. There's like a spark. That seems to me so like a beautiful expression of this idea of contact, which suffuses the whole book. Like when you put two things together, like a spark happens, a thing happens. So yeah, so this abutment is like an example of contact. And this contact is the focus of part one. And it also shows up in part two, but now contrasted with networking, which is a very different thing. And we'll talk about those. So the two parts are the same, but also completely different. And I'll, a lot of times in my head, refer to them as Times Square Blue, Times Square Red. But the titles are actually slightly different. On the first one, it's titled Times Square Blue, and then there's a date, October 1996. And then the other one's titled 3-2-1 Contact, Times Square Red. So it's like one is blue, one is red. And both of them are situated with regard to time, but the first one is the date when it was completed, October 1996. So it's kind of capturing a particular period, crystallizing it in amber or something. And then the other one is also evoking time, but it's kind of explosive and like about the right now, like not the remembered past, but the right now, 3-2-1, pow, right? And the first part, Times Square Blue is, I would say, it's almost like a love story, not for a person, but for a place and for a time that's gone. And so there's a kind of nostalgia to it. I found myself thinking, I know this sounds crazy, about Hemingway's Movable Feast at certain moments. I mean, obviously, they're totally different, but this idea of a city where you were young, where these things happened to you and you remember it and it's still part of you, but it's also far away. It seemed there was a real kind of haunting quality about that. And so Delaney talks about the area around Times Square, like those few blocks, and more generally about the sex clubs and gay bars in that area. And above all, he talks about the people he met there. And the, I don't know if you felt this too, but I felt like the portraits of the people, like these little sketches, these little encounters, are so vivid. Like, I read this book for the second time getting ready for today, and it was like seeing almost old friends or acquaintances. Like, oh yeah, I remember him. I remember him. Like, they were like people.
Yeah, they're strikingly good quick sketches. Again, yeah. The sort of journalistic mode. I mean, he's written a lot of fiction. He's very good at creating characters and getting them on the page efficiently, but this was a much more journalistic way of doing it, and it was completely effective.
Yeah, I know. I felt that. Anyway, the second part is more discursive, more academic. It's written it's also beautifully written, but in a different kind of style. And it's about the difference between contact and networking. Contact is something that enables the meeting of people from different classes, and it brings about real change, like something happens, and we'll talk more about that. Networking, on the other hand, maintains existing structures. We all know how networking works, the conference, the work setting, you know, but it maintains everything intact. You might gain a little or lose a little, but the system is always going to stay just the same. And he brings that out in part two. And one of the things I just absolutely love about the abutment of these two parts, two parts are the same and also utterly different, is layout, like what they do visually. So Times Square Blue has photos embedded in it, quite a number. And they're not like whole page photos generally. They're like part of a page. They're part of that organic whole of the page. And the captions are often really haunting. And these are pictures Delaney's taken himself. So it feels like somebody's photo album almost, you know?
They're mostly ones he took. Some of them are taken by a photographer for a magazine article that this was originally published as part of. And it does look like, the layout is like a magazine article where you might have a photo inset of the person that's being talked about.
Yeah, I think to both of those things, like that's definitely true. The magazine-y quality is there, but also, I don't know if you felt it, like, it felt like photo album-y too in a way, like, because it was intimate. Like there were people that were evoked in words on the page in this really haunting way, and then there they are, right? And Times Square Red does something different. It has side commentaries in a boldface type, almost marginal glosses that open up another dimension of his analysis. And there's just this one moment almost in which the two parts converge. I was really struck by, there's this one photograph that appears both in Times Square Blue and in Times Square Red. And it's captioned in the first. It's a guy called Daryl that he knows. And in the second one, it's not captioned with his name or anything like that, not captioned at all. And you don't see his name in the text. There's just a reference to people who are hustlers. And if you remember Daryl, you recognize him. Right. So his name and his story are there for you. You know what I mean? If you read the first part. And so that kind of, it's almost like a wormhole between two universes. I mean, that's how it felt to me. It was so cool.
Yeah. And he's also there in between the main text and a sidebar, and both of which are discussing hustlers at that moment.
Yeah.
So he's sort of in between stitching the two halves of the book and then the two halves of this essay together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that's so neat. Anyway, so this is a book that is amazing in a number of different ways, and form is one of them.
It is a really smartly laid out book. And I also have to say, like, as a physical object, I've got the hardcover from when it first came out, and it's got a really satisfying heft to it. Like, it's a really thick and heavy board in the hardcover, and then the pages are a little bit thicker than usual. And it's also just a little bit wider than you'd expect, considering how tall it is. Like, the aspect ratio is a little bit off. And it's really satisfying to hold and flip through and read as a physical object. So it's really well thought through.
Do you feel like that was really purposeful? In other words, is the bookiness of this book part of its message in some sense, do you think? I mean, always you want to have a beautifully produced book, but right? But this one's striking.
Yeah, I mean, it's New York University Press that published it. I assume that they often take care with books, or at least they might have back in the 90s when you had more of an option to. I don't know. It was very thoughtfully put together. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I guess maybe one of the reasons I asked that question is because especially the first part, Times Square Blue, is preoccupied kind of with what's left when a time is gone and a place is being kind of evacuated. I keep using the word elegiac. There are these elegiac kinds of moments, and these kind of like fragments, descriptions of fragments that kind of connect to that past. And that's why I was thinking about the bookiness and that connection. There's this one moment that I really loved. It's a caption. Mary mentioned the captions are kind of haunting in some cases. There's one caption to an image that's in the last parts of Times Square Blue. And he talks about the young men who are standing there within the year, the buildings behind with the gates down before their windows will also be torn down. And he goes on, he says, when a year after this picture was taken in October 1996, the building was demolished. Substantial pieces of his mirrors and mosaics clung to the brick wall for another year till they too were pulled down, a glittering reminder of the young men who had worked there. Mm. I think it's so beautiful. And also, you know, this picture was taken in October 1996, right? That's that timestamp again that is in the title.
Were you in New York at that time?
Well, not in the 90s. Actually, I had just moved to Toronto in 95, so just before. But I knew that strip super well because right after I finished college, so 84 through like 86, periodically was living in the city, but there were periods when I was living at my folks out in New Jersey, right? So I'd take the bus in to the Port Authority, and I would walk from just west of Times Square to East 44th Street. And I was working at night in the early period of the time. And then I would walk back like around just before midnight, because that's when I catch the bus, right? And so, like, I was a teenager. I was like 19 years old, right? So like, when he talks about the whole actual violence in contradistinction to the fears of violence and the fantasy of violence and like the imagination of what that area was versus the reality of what that area was. Like, for me, that's so visceral. Like, it brings back so vividly that walk, which was weird for me, right? Because I was really young. And, you know, like, on the one hand, I was like super vigilant and I always walk really fast, but I also felt completely at home there because I was walking through there all the time, you know?
Yeah. I think we'll talk more about that aspect of the violence in a little bit. But I also spent a lot of my teenage years, well, not a lot of them, but enough of them in that neighborhood. I had a job in sort of Hell's Kitchen and used to walk by Port Authority all the time, and sometimes would even walk by this stretch of Times Square with all the theaters on it. Mm-hmm. Although I knew that that was like a weird and dangerous street, and actually walking down Times Square on that block was always, at least at that time, a bit, you don't want to do that. You probably don't want to do that. I mean, again, I don't know if there's actually anything to be afraid of there, but it definitely was culturally, you know, you're told that. And so the sense of mystery hanging about these theaters, like what actually goes on in there?
Totally.
Did you have any sense of that before you read this book about the procedure, the logistics, or even just like the nature of the sex that may, you know, you probably assumed was happening inside these theaters?
Well, not the theaters, but like, so it was complicated. So during the period of time when I, you know, so in the mid 80s, right? So when I was around there, I remember passing those theaters and like they had exactly that kind of aura you're describing, where it was like scary, yet also kind of like exciting. You were like, you know, it's dangerous. I shouldn't be here. And yet I am here, you know, right? While I never was in any of those theaters, the sometimes slightly rough bar scene was something I was familiar with, like within, you know, like around that same time and in the couple of years after. And, you know, so there's some things that were quite unfamiliar, like when he describes how the theaters worked and how admission worked and the different kinds of people he encountered there, like that was not part of my experience. But certain parts of that world he was describing were familiar. And so the nostalgia that emerges from part one, from Times Square Blue, was in part something that Delaney's totally put there. But in part, I'm sure it was coming from my own affect, being like, oh, yeah, I remember that kind of. And like that, you know, that whole Anna story that he tells about taking his female friend with him.
Yes. Why don't you tell what the story is?
It's a very strange little story. So women in general in here are kind of weird. Like, it's not bad, but it's odd the way women function here and the kind of social logic. And so that is something we might talk about as well. So I think the way she's introduced into the story is actually really interesting. So this is a friend of his called Anna, and he's just been talking about how the pornography works, because the gay sex that's happening in the theaters is sometimes accompanied by gay pornography, but at other times it's straight pornography. It's straight sex that's happening on the screen, right? And so he talks a little bit about what's going on there, like what is the function of the woman, and which he has in quotation marks, this is a kind of abstract thing, in the generation of desire and how desire is going to work in this setting, right? Even the elegiac first part, Times Square Blue, even that has this kind of really interesting analysis happening. So he says, this would seem to require that someone point out vigorously that its charm, sociality, and warmth, if it has any, depend entirely on the absence of the woman, or at least depend on flattening the woman, and until she is only an image on a screen, whether of light or memory, reduced to pure sexuality, till a magical essence, a mystical energy, she pervades, grounds, even fuels the entire process, from which she is corporally, intellectually, emotionally, and politically absent. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting passage. Interesting. So it's on the heels of that analysis of the woman as an abstraction that he talks about bringing his friend Anna to the theater.
Yeah.
And that, so I thought that was a really interesting kind of staging. Like, what does it look like when you bring an actual live woman to these things, right?
Exactly. It's a question that, like, in the story, he doesn't even know the answer to, right?
No,
like, he has a sense that, yeah, women sometimes come in, sometimes couples come in, but, like, he doesn't really have a sense of what those women are like. He's not really engaging with the women that men are bringing into these movies. So what is it like for a woman to come in? What would that mean? And he's super curious about it.
Yeah. No, I mean, he mentions that occasionally a prostitute will be brought in by a man, and he'll refer to couples. But, you know, he doesn't bring it out, but presumably, how can I put it, the intersocial dynamic between the men might be such that maybe you don't share with. I mean, like, I don't know, right? So he's not in that space. But he brings his friend Anna, who's curious and wants to come see what it's like. And so he brings her in, they sort of look around a little bit, and he leaves her for a little bit while he does a sort of once around the space. And then she also sort of explores. And then as the time in there unfolds, they witness or watch or sort of privy to sexual activity that's happening there. And there's this one moment that I found really interesting. I don't know if there are parts of it that you found really interesting, but
I mean, I find the whole thing interesting.
The whole thing is incredibly interesting. So when they're first coming in together, the guy who's like watching the door says, hey, wait, that's a woman. She's coming in with you. That's fine, but you better not be like pimping her out here. Like, in other words, there better be no money changing hands. And Delaney's like, no, that's fine. That's definitely not going to happen. So that's all fine. But then they're in the theater and they're watching, you know, guys doing stuff. And then during a lull, as several other of the observers have been doing from time to time, she reached in to feel the man. And with a sudden frown, though he did not pull back, I and Anna both realized that only then had he seen she was a woman. Anna let go and stepped quickly back, though. And it's such an odd moment, like when you think about like inside, outside, you know, what's happening there community-wise. Like, she's there and it's fine, but there's also this, I don't know what to call it. Like, it's, you know, like you have two magnets and they like, you put them together the wrong way and they repel.
Okay,
it's, yeah. There's something force fieldy here, kind of, you know, like he does not pull back. She let go and stepped quickly back, though. So she's there, and it's fine, but it's also, there's things going on that she's just not part of in that way.
Yeah, she's not expected there. She's not part of this. I mean, community is one way of thinking about it, but that's a little off. But in terms of the demographics, let's say, of people that you'd expect to encounter, she's not part of that.
Yeah. And it's not that people are mean to her or unwelcoming to her. There's this other moment a little bit early on where, you know, they figure out, somebody notices, that's a girl. And the other guy's like, oh, it's fine. You know, keep doing what you're doing, right? And they keep doing what they're doing. And then one of them's like, is this all right for you? He asked Anna. And she's like, oh, sure, go on. Right. So these things are happening and they're sharing and it's like open for her. She's just watching. But so it's I don't know how to describe it. It's like a world that's open and yet not open. I mean, again, very science fiction-y. It's really weird.
The one guy who's going down on the other guy that they're watching offers, you know, that he'll take care of Samuel Delaney if she wants to enjoy this guy for a bit. And she's like, no, it's fine. But it's all very polite. And I think that's one of the things that she's especially struck with when they debrief afterwards. It's like, I didn't think there would be so much, but I also didn't think like it would be so easy to say no.
Yeah.
And that people would say no so much more often than you'd expect. And Delaney says something like, well, you know, yeah, maybe, you know, one out of eight times you'll get a yes, but you keep asking, you're going to get so many yeses. Who cares about the no's?
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. Like, yeah, there's this moment where they're debriefing at the end and she's like, oh, one guy made a pass at me. He really thought I might say yes. And when I said, no, thank you, he smiled, shrugged. He did look sad and walked away. I laughed at her surprise. We pushed through the drapes. And one of the reasons that moment stands out so much is it's a moment of like the opposite of violence. Like this is like, there's, you know, somebody might, you know, make a pass at you, right? Or invite you to have sex, but there's no pressure. Like nobody's going to be aggressive with you or, you know, like the hitting on you that happens all the time in the regular world. It does not happen here. Like the aggression, the pushing.
This is a thing that on this read through, I was a bit surprised to realize Delaney doesn't talk about, which is that part of the thing that makes this so striking for her is that, yeah, you would expect that when you turn someone down, especially in a highly sexualized environment like this, that there would be consequences, that a guy wouldn't just say, oh, well, and move on, but they would actually like get aggressive or get demandy or like, what did you come here for? Well, you can imagine, like, you can play this all out in your head. And like, this is a space where men expect to be told no. And like, you know, it's worth a try, but if you don't get it, oh well.
And it's all the more striking because violence is the specter, right? Like this whole, the time, maybe we're talking about, you know, being like, you know, a callow teen and being like, oh, is that a street I should walk on, right? Like, because you've got this incredible mythos of how dangerous it is and stuff like that, right? But the violence that's the specter is precisely absent when you're inside there.
The second half of the book is talking explicitly about the plans to revitalize, quote unquote, Times Square, which have happened, by the way, spoiler alert, it happened. Mm-hmm. And it is now much more of a, quote unquote, friendly tourist destination. And it's awful. Never go.
Oh, it's just awful. It's just awful.
So awful. But one of the ideas behind this was that it would be safer and explicitly safer for women. Mm-hmm. And Delaney takes a lot of interesting issue with both the assumption of violence, but also sort of the neglect of the effects of this change that would happen on the women who are already living and working there.
Well, what he brings out really beautifully is this way in which, you know, the justification that the neighborhood would be safer for women, it's a highly cynical commercial strategy, right? He brings that out. And then also he points out the fact that, you know, what actually happens with revitalization in this kind of project is the neighborhood gets wrecked. You know, all the little shops, the places you get something to eat, differently priced residential spaces, that all gets wrecked. And that has a terrible impact on women. It also creates it's a kind of social violence, right? So he's real clear about that. One of the things he brings out when he's talking about these revitalization efforts is what they do to the neighborhoods, how they drive out the little restaurants, how they drive out little shops, different places people might live, you know, differently priced rental housing and so on. They wreck the neighborhood. And in that analysis that Delaney offers, you know, in a really sort of journalistic and personal way in Times Square Blue and in a more abstract and academic argument kind of way in Times Square Red, it's very original, but it's also drawing on the work of Jane Jacobs. And he actually alludes to her a couple times in each part in a really interesting way. Have you ever read her work?
I haven't, unfortunately. I've always meant to read The Death and Life of Great American Cities, but I just haven't gotten around to it yet. There are so many books.
I literally have it in my hand here because I've read the first like 20 pages. No. Actually, I find I've read the first 50 pages, looking here, like four times. And it's an incredibly interesting book as a kind of a milestone in thinking about cities and how cities might work. Came out in 1961, and it's been republished a number of times, and it's been kind of a touchstone for people thinking about what makes cities go, what makes neighborhoods work. And it's a kind of an intertext for Delaney. He doesn't talk about Jacobs directly very often. There's one passage in Times Square Blue and one passage in Times Square Red where he talks about her, he quotes her and sort of alludes to her specifically. But her analysis, and especially, and he acknowledges this, her way of talking about contact, the way she defines contact, he builds on that, but he brings it out into the world of sexual exchange, which is something she doesn't talk about.
No. So what exactly are we talking about when we say contact?
Well, he gives this really neat definition of it near the beginning of Times Square Red. It's actually a really, really long sentence that sort of just, and it ends with a really kind of a list almost of the different kinds of contact that can happen. So here's a little bit of a description. He says, contact is the conversation that starts in the line at the grocery counter with the person behind you while the clerk is changing the paper roll in the cash register. It is the pleasantries exchanged with a neighbor who has brought her chair out to take some air on the stoop. It is the discussion that begins with the person next to you at a bar. It could be the conversation that starts with any number of semi-officials or service persons, mailman, policeman, librarian, store clerk, or counterperson. That's all Jacobs, right? As well, he's not quoting her, but like she says that kind of stuff. And then he goes on. As well, it can be two men watching each other masturbating together in adjacent urinals of a public john. An encounter that, later, may or may not become a conversation. Very importantly, contact is also the intercourse, physical and conversational, that blooms in and as casual sex. And then he goes on giving many other examples of contact. And so it's kind of neat because what he's woven together here is Jacob's account of contact, right? But he's added a whole other layer onto it that it's not just like one more kind of contact, like the grocery store, the front stoop, you know, the mailman, you know, the sex, you know, it's like, it's not just like one more kind. He's actually bringing out, what does it look like when that's embodied? It's like a whole nother layer almost, right? So it's not just one more in a series of kinds of contact, but it's like, what does it happen when the body is the site of that social intercourse?
That's really interesting. I should say first off that that section about standing in the line at the supermarket, I remember as being much bigger in this book because that became the way that I think about this kind of contact and the way I would explain it to other people in the 20 years since I first read it.
He has another passage where he talks about being in line at the grocery store back in Times Square Blue. So maybe those can be juxtaposed.
Yeah, I guess so. But like that idea of, oh, you don't know who you're going to stand in line next to, and therefore it could be anybody. And if you strike up a conversation. Like, contact doesn't guarantee anything's going to happen. It just creates situations where cross-cultural, cross-class, cross-whatever other divides you might have, encounters might happen and might unexpectedly turn fruitful. Mm-hmm. And or lead to, you know, hand jobs. Whatever.
One of those things.
It's all good. And so... And so this is a really interesting idea, but this notion that you're bringing up that it's sort of more embodied here, I guess that's true. I mean, all the rest are so conversational or, you know, even if they are material, you know, somebody that you decide to lend a book to, you know, you talk with somebody you meet randomly and they're really interested in the topic. And so at least if you're Delaney, you lend books to people all the time, apparently, and you may or may not get them back or ever talk to them again. And that's fine because you were doing a solid or something. So I guess there is some materiality, but this is a very explicitly bodily version of that. And that is really intriguing.
Yeah, I think that this notion of embodied contact is kind of running like, I don't know what to call it, like a counterpoint through both Times Square Blue and Times Square Red, because we talk about the vividness with which he gives you these different people. And you know, you have like, it's a little character sketch and you kind of feel like you know them. So in Times Square Blue, there's Gary, who always brings this quart bottle of beer with him when he goes to the films. There's Tommy, who he encounters many times over a long period, who Delaney invites to come have breakfast with him, to meet him for breakfast at his home, but he just never comes because he's fearful that it's not a real offer. And there's Joey, there's Arlie, there's all these different guys, right? And there's something that's part of that contact, that physical contact. But in part two, also in Times Square Red, there are also contact stories that show up, and they are also like embodied or physical in a certain kind of way. Like there's a materiality to them. So for example, there's that example he gives of the marathon runner. Do you remember that? He says, I had a friend who was a marathon runner, and he was not like such a great marathon runner, but he'd like always run about 10 miles. And then when a marathon was coming up, he would start like slowly amping up to get closer to the proper period, right? So one time he's out running and there's a woman who's yelling because her purse has been stolen. And so he says, oh, don't worry. I'll get it. And so he goes running after this like 14, 15 year old has stolen the purse. And he knows that there's no way this kid can outrun him because, you know, he just stays about 5 yards behind the kid all the way, but like, kid's not going to outrun the marathon runner. So the poor kid like collapses after like 10 minutes and he gets the purse and he goes back, runs back. And the woman's already left because I guess she's all freaked out, but her ID's in the purse. So he's able to get it back to her. So that he says, this is an example of contact. So like that, the purse is in a way the site of contact. And then there's the example of, he talks about how there's this contact that happens, you know, looking at books in front of a bookstore, the time that Ray Bradbury was complaining about how science fiction books never get reviewed in the papers, but he was complaining about it to this guy he was talking to, who happened to be Christopher Isherwood, who was writing reviews anyway. And so we did a review.
And launched Bradbury's career outside of the science fiction realm and into sort of greater literary circles.
Yeah, exactly. And also like did something for the visibility of science fiction itself, right?
Yeah.
To some extent. And so the book there that they're talking over, you know, the book that's in their hands, right, is the kind of sight. And then my favorite one, which I think is incredibly beautiful, I don't know if you remember this passage, where he's talking about a comet that he sees in the sky.
Oh, yes. Hale Bopp, specifically.
Yeah. So it's pretty near the end of Times Square Red. And he talks about, you know, pointing out to one person, another person, and these whole bunch of people, they're all brought together by the thing they're looking at. And it sort of passes on. So one person tells another, and it's not just a chain, like it kind of doubles back on itself. So there's this lovely, lovely end to the passage. He says, a minute later, I pointed it out again to a homeless man in his 20s with blackened hands and short black hair who'd set his plastic garbage bag down to dig in a garbage container for soda and beer cans. Oh, wow, yeah. Slowly, he stood up to rub his forehead. That's neat. While I walked on, a moment later, I glanced back to see he'd stopped an older Hispanic gentleman in an overcoat with a pencil-thin mustache who now stood with him, gazing up. There, you see the comet? With my cane, I walked up my stoop steps, carrying my groceries and my notebook into the vestibule, where I unlocked the door and pushed into the lobby. And I just love that moment, because it's the end of a long description of like all these different people, like a whole series of contacts, right, that are sparked by the comet, right? And the last contact is not Delaney with somebody else, but he's been in contact with this homeless man, right, with the blackened hands, like not abject figure, but he's like, kind of on the edge, right? And that guy on the edge talks to the Hispanic gentleman with the mustache and passes it on there, right? And Delaney then moves through this, like, you know, like liminal space. Like he moves in through the vestibule, through the door, into the lobby, and out of the zone of contact. It's, like, so cool. Anyway, so it's always physical. And whether it's sex or something else, it's always, there's an object. It's the comet. It's the book. It's the purse.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think the distinction between the more physical, like more embodied one is what intrigued me about what you were saying earlier. Although, yes, there is often something sort of at discussion here.
Because it's not just the sex, though. It's the sandwiches and the Coke and the stuff like that that he brings in for, you know, his companions or whoever he's talking to, right?
Yeah, somebody who needs it. He decides they need it. He'll go out and get a sandwich for somebody. He's a good guy. The other thing about that comet scene is where he's coming from. He's just participated in a 3-day conference on, quote, forms of desire at the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at the SUNY Graduate Center. Mm-hmm. And so he's coming out of this academic conference, which, you know, is a networking event. It's this other mode of interaction that he's comparing with and trying very hard not to make it seem like contact good, network bad. But he's interested in the notion of, like, what is the quality of meeting people through networking, through these formal situations where everybody is going there to meet people who are there for the same reason. You know, we're all academics here. We're all, you know, you're at a writer's conference. We're all writers here, et cetera. And they all kind of want similar things. The people who don't have the power, at least in the room, you know, they want to meet the literary agent who will get them their first novel published, or they want to impress the other academics who will later hire them or whatever, you know, where you've got that kind of economy of interaction versus contact, where you have people who are meeting from all sorts of different walks of life, like the various people that he describes showing the comet to on his way home from the conference. And how, as Jane Jacobs would put it, you need that diversity of contact to have a city thrive. This is one of the things about that purse snatching story that you told, is that, you know, he didn't know that woman, the guy who saved the purse.
No.
He just happened to be there. This is pure contact. Both the robbery, the act of violence, but also the saving from violence occur because of this kind of contact. And if you don't encourage contact, you end up reducing the likelihood that somebody's going to be looking out for you. Somebody randomly will be there to save your purse or somebody attacks you. It flattens things out and increases the possibility of violence in many ways.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. So violence is like a word. The word I don't think shows up a whole lot in this book, but it's something that's there imminently an awful lot of the time, whether it's this kind of, you know, manufactured specter or whether it's a danger of real violence. It seems like it's like below the surface in a whole lot of different places. And in particular, you know, the violence of the renovation, you know, like the I don't know what to call it, the anonymous violence that comes from above, right? As the city is reshaped or, you know, the neighborhood is destroyed by this revitalization project.
Exactly. I mean, the book is, in a sense, and this is incredibly reductive to say, like, look at where the real violence is, sheeple. But I mean, it's not. Like, it's much more thoughtful than that. But there's a sense in which, yeah, we're going to mention violence occasionally, but really what we're trying to do is get past the reader's learned sense of what is violent and what is not, and then actually show them, like, both show them through memoir, through here's my lived experience, it wasn't as violent as you think. It was occasionally violent in very specific ways, but overall, it was not what you think it was. And then also a theoretical look at it, like, okay, here's why this wouldn't be violent as you might think it would be, and here's why what you're doing is only going to increase the chances of violence.
That's right. Yeah, he gets into that in a really neat way in Times Square Red when he's talking about the actual you know, numbers around violence if you look at a small town versus if you look at the city. There's this perception that the city is the site of violence. But he says, you know, if you look at the like actual annual numbers, you're more likely to suffer violence or even death because you're looking at murder rates in a small town. And he sort of brings out this like perception versus the reality and what brings that about. And he says this kind of really interesting thing, at least a passage I was really struck by both in terms of like the content of what he says and also how it resonated with my own remembered experience. So this is in red. He says, in general, the city is a pretty safe place, though the violence that occurs there is largely random. There are certainly specific types of big city smarts, walking next to the curb on dark streets, listening on sparsely populated streets to make sure the group of people coming up behind you are engaged in conversation, a sense of what streets to avoid, at which hours. Those areas where violence may reasonably be expected with some frequency, often the first place the tourist sees, the bus station, the train station, the streets around Times Square, tend to operate on a largely small town model and thus can usually be negotiated with ordinary, dare I say it, small town common sense. But the comparative urban paucity of violence is among the most powerful factors constituting the freedom of action and thought, so often called opportunity, that small towns simply cannot proffer. Mm-hmm. And the language is kind of dense there, but I was like, that's a really compelling argument for what the city can give you. You know?
Yeah. And I love the passage where he describes his own time living in, for a summer in a small town in Pennsylvania where five people died. Yeah. And he goes into detail about, well, three of the people were these sort of Hatfield-McCoy families who were always being violent towards each other. If you don't want to be part of that violence, just avoid them. Mm-hmm. And the other two were this terrible incident where some teens just pushed a car off a cliff or something, and the couple from out of town just died in it. And then, like, because it's a small town, like, nobody wants the kids to be really punished, so they basically get a slap on the wrist and get sent to military school or something. But, like... It's like, wow, this is terrible. But the flavor of these types of incidents are so different from what happens in the city.
Yeah.
And it's this unfamiliarity with on either side of like, what is the exact nature of the threat in both the small town and in the big city?
Yeah.
That overly colors people's imaginations.
Yeah, he brings out these really interesting things. I mean, first of all, there's more violence in the town than there is in the city. And then the fact that if it's in the town, it's like not anonymous. Like you kind of, you know what produces it. It's local. It's not random, right? It's got all these local conditions attached to it. In the city, it's random. There's an unpredictability about it, except for the small town quality of places that you know and you navigate, you know, like the small town model, the streets around Times Square, right? If you know it, you're fine, right? If you don't know it, that's when you're going to get into trouble. Like if it's your neighborhood, you're going to be fine.
Yeah. But again, also like the fact that he tells his own personal story and gets you hooked on like the lurid details of what happened and his own experience. And then also puts forward this theoretical explanation for what's going on. Like here's my lived experience. And then here is a theoretical understanding. It's again, this sort of the form of the book as a whole in miniature. It's really powerful.
Totally. Totally. When you read it originally, were you drawn to just one part and not the other? Like, did you read both parts with equal engagement? Like, the first part is the one that's, like, kind of mind-blowing because it's, like, you know, like, yeah, it's other
it's
world.
Lurid and it's and it's exotic, so to speak, for me, for a lot of people.
Yeah. And beautifully, written.
And sad in many parts. And, like, mm-hmm. there's definitely people whose lives go off the rails and who die of various reasons. And there's incredibly sad parts to that section as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, and incredibly hot parts, let's say. Mm-hmm. I loved both of them, I have to say. Like, I loved the detail. I loved the forthrightness with which he gave forward those details. It still reads as shocking. I mean, I think he said something about, you know, Jane Jacobs didn't talk about the sex because, you know, you couldn't then, but we can now. And it's just like, no, most people can't talk about it as well and as honestly as you do. Like,
yeah,
he puts a lot on the table, and he puts even more on the table in some of his other nonfiction writing. So,
yeah.
So that impressed me a lot. But also the theoretical argument, I also loved that. Like it was, again, because I hadn't read Jacobs, because I hadn't read a lot of other stuff like this. It was such a clear and powerful explanation of a lot of the dynamics that were at play. I mean, honestly, this book made it seem almost like a moral imperative to go and sleep around with anonymous people.
Well, it is a political argument, a really powerful political argument, right, that he's making.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, boy, that's not for me, but I every time I read this book, I catch the religion.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's this lovely passage where, here's a beautiful example where he's making the political argument in a really compelling way. And this is pretty close to the end of Times Square Blue. He says, "The easy argument already in place to catch up these anecdotes is that social institutions such as the porn movies take up a certain social excess, are even perhaps socially beneficial to some small part of it, a margin outside the margin. But that is the same argument that allows them to be dismissed and physically smashed and flattened. They are relevant only to that margin. No one else cares." Well, in a democracy, that is not an acceptable argument. People are not excess. It is the same argument that dismisses the needs of blacks, Jews, Hispanics, Asians, women, gays, the homeless, the poor, the worker, and all other margins that, taken together, people like you, people like me, are the country's overwhelming majority. Those who, socioeconomically, are simply less powerful.
I mean,
I'm like, preach it.
You may not be surprised that I had that page open when I was planning to veer the conversation towards that very passage. Yeah.
We are one. We
that
are
was
one.
Such a lovely passage to reread, let's say this week in early November 2020. Yes. That was real great. And it's true. And like that, I'm sure I would have agreed with that even before I first read it, but I feel that as a political truism today, and it has guided me throughout my life.
Yeah, so I mean, the power of this book is like on like, I don't know, like five different levels. It's kind of extraordinary. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. So I'm curious about this book and how you read it as, let's say, an academic. This is not an academic book, but it's doing the sort of thing that academic books often do, which is to say it's intervening in a conversation that's happening around a few issues. It's putting forth some proposals. It's drawing upon other texts that are doing it. It's drawing on evidence in various different ways. It's putting out theoretical arguments. Like, it is kind of academic in some senses. I don't know. Does that jive with how you read it? Does it fit in that context at all? You know, even without having a massive apparatus of footnotes. And if so, does this work point you in directions where you might want to take your own academic writing?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And funnily enough, I hadn't been thinking about it consciously until we're just talking now, like it, which surprises me because you'd think it would have been present in my mind. Yeah, like the short answer is yeah. So the book is these two parts, right? And they're very different. They're abutting one another, right? They're doing something up against. We're thinking through and against these two things, right? And one of them is more memoir-y and journalistic and kind of literary almost, right? And then the other is more argumentative, more academic. It's set out with sections numbered, almost like the way you would find in a philosophy text or something like that, right? So it's sort of giving you a visual way of thinking about these two different modes, right? So they're kind of treading the same or similar or related ground, but they're doing it in totally different ways. And the reason that strikes me so much is because I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, you know, are there ways of writing about literature in particular, history too, I guess, but I was thinking about it with regard to literature, that are themselves kind of more creative? And even, can you write in two ways at once? Can you write something that's partly reflective and personal and then partly analytical and anatomical almost, right? And I think that's the circumstance under which you mentioned this book to me first. I don't know, might have been me talking to you about like this desire to think of these two different modes of writing. And so I find it incredibly stimulating in that way. I think the thing I find most stimulating in it is, again, this visual layout that we talked about, like the way the photos are working and the way the glosses in the margin in Times Square Red work. The other book that I'm thinking about as I look what Delaney's done here, and I don't know if you've read it, is Anne Carson's Knox.
I haven't read Knox, but I certainly know about it. That is the collection of text that comes in a kind of box, right?
Yeah, and it's, I don't know what to call it, it's a response to the death of her brother. And so it's a collection of translations and short prose pieces and photos and captions. So it's got that, you know, that sort of personal photo quality that I was talking about a little bit in part one of Delaney's Times Square. It's got that kind of effect. And so it's very different in many ways, but this idea that, you know, putting pieces together and creating juxtapositions makes something happen in your reader that's different from what you can do if you're being kind of very direct. I find that really exciting and interesting.
I was also thinking a little bit about the Lee Marichal book that we looked at, Memory Serves, which also had a few essays that were really interesting mixes of more theoretical material, more personal material, more literary material, and formal things sometimes as well. And I know you got very excited about that book as well for similar reasons.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting you mention it, because actually I was just thinking about it and talking about it with somebody earlier today. I think you're right that it's a good book to juxtapose with this conversation, because it's also, it's doing something different. It's pushing us in a direction. It's inviting us to think in a direction and to work in a direction and to write and speak in a direction that we're not accustomed to. But it's very different, I think, from what Delaney's doing, in that it's Lee Marichal's Memory Serves, especially her oratory on oratory, which is in some ways, I think, the heart of that book. It's inviting you to think about oral modes, words that kind of dance on your skin, right? And thinking about what does it mean to translate oratory, right? Which is oral, which is spoken, and which is immediate, and which is dependent on those who are listening to it. What does it mean to translate that or to render that as written text, like make it into a book? And here, it strikes me that it's so much more, Delaney's work is so much more committed to the written as opposed to the oral, and the visual, like the visual layout and the spatial layout. And that strikes me as very different. So they're both incredibly creative books, but I think in very different directions, like different vectors, kind of. One thinking about orality and speeches that emerges from the body. This visual, the written, but again, I guess, grounding meaning in what bodies give you, right? What for Delaney, what the intercourse of bodies gives you, right? But by which I mean both physical, sexual intercourse and also social and oral speech, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know how much input he had in terms of the layout of the book, but he is sort of a notorious proofreader, let's say, in that books of his keep coming out and he keeps publishing addendas and they keep revising things. And, you know, he would have looked at the proofs and he would have made his voice heard if he didn't like what he saw.
I'd be curious to know, because I think very brilliantly laid out. And that means either it's something he oversaw or somebody who was very much in tune with what he's trying to do, I think, was doing that layout.
Yeah, it's an incredibly thoughtful layout. I'm not sure who did it. I don't know if it's listed.
But even just that idea of using photos in the way that they're used in part one and the captions, and then the glosses in part two, I find that really interesting. What do you think about the glosses? What do you think they're trying to do? You know, the sections of the text in part two are numbered, and then the glosses are kind of have letters attached to them.
So a lot of them are sort of providing other types of context for what's being discussed without trying to interrupt the flow. It's interesting. I was going to say without interrupting the flow. But of course, you have to interrupt the flow in order to read them. So it's, you know, it's meant to be read sort of in parallel or thought about in parallel rather than in sequence. But you can't actually literally read two texts at the same time. But it encourages you to hold them in your head in the same way. It's a technique he uses in the last chapter in Dahlgren as well, where it's a sort of palimpsestic chapter, and there are those same kind of sidebar bits that go throughout it. And it's a thing that's been used in a few other academic essays in similar ways. Kristeva's Stabat Mater, right? It does that.
Yeah. Well, I kept thinking also about Walter Benjamin's Arcades project.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Because he also has got some of the most dynamic kind of passages in terms of the layout in Times Square Red. He's explicitly talking about, you know, aura and talking about cities, and he mentions Paris. So I'm like, oh, I wonder if he's like sort of inviting us to think about this.
I'm pretty sure he's familiar with it, yes.
Yeah, no, but I mean, inviting us to, I mean, he doesn't mention him at all, but like inviting us to think about it.
No, but I'm sure it's on his mind.
Yeah. I have to ask you, did you notice the section, the marginal glosses about the theater district? And I was so struck by that, because we're in a moment when that's all getting, like something different's going to emerge from the ashes of that, right? He talks about how the big theaters are just run by these two big organizations. Real creativity, small theater is just being totally squeezed out. And he says that, you know, maybe someday, you know, it'll be revived in some other kind of way. And I'm like, wow, we're exactly in that moment where the theaters, like the bad news is that the theaters are being crushed, like by which I mean the Broadway theaters, right? And the good news is that the theaters are being crushed, right? Because maybe smaller theatrical spaces will, you know, rise in to replace them.
I mean, I'd hope so, but yeah. I'm a little bit dubious about that. Yeah. I don't know what's going on the ground there. This was a really interesting book to read at this moment, right? This book about contact, when I haven't left the house barely in the last year, right? Yeah. Like, I went to the mall today to do an errand, which was
that
wild.
Like?
yeah, I haven't done that in a while. And reading this just made me think again about like, oh man, I really miss contact, right? Like I miss just encountering people in the wild, even though, you know, I'm not as outgoing as Delaney is, where I'm talking with every person I meet and I'm not, you know, striking up conversations and I'm not having as many encounters, but just like the fact that there's been none of that,
yeah,
that every encounter with a person is sort of prearranged.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This book has been a reminder of one of the many reasons why this past year has been so hard. Well, I would love to talk for a few more million years about Samuel Delaney and this book.
It's so good.
This has, by the way, been the first part of our sex cluster. I think this gave us a lot of...
That sounded really dirty.
It did. I think it's given us a lot of things to think about when we encounter other works about sex and also, you know, other works about just politics, like the way that people interact with one another. That's a major concern of this. And it argues that sex is an important vector in thinking about that in a way that a lot of theoreticians seemingly haven't incorporated as well as they might, or as thoughtfully as Samuel Delaney is going to. So I will be curious to see how that plays out in the next text, which is a slightly different text.
We're going to read the Mahabharata, which is a magnificent, incredibly important epic, and it's going to be a challenge for us because it's super, super long. So I don't think we're going to read the whole thing, but we're going to read
I'm not. Lots. I'm going to say right now, I will not be reading all million lines or whatever it is.
No, I mean, it's true. But we're going to read respectfully and carefully, and I think it's going to be a really interesting discussion because there's so much to say about it.
I'm super curious. I've been meaning to try it for a long time. But until then, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at spouter@megaphonic.fm or we're on Twitter @thespouter. We'd love to hear from you. Show notes with links for anything we've mentioned in this episode will be at megaphonic.fm/spouter/37. And The Spouter Inn is one of the fancy little podcasts over at Megaphonic FM. So until next time.
Until next time. See you again at The Spouter Inn.